on the Lower East Side. It was where I grew up and spent the first 10 years of my life. My father, Monroe Small, couldn't make a living in the Jim Crow South. He left us and went to Detroit. He got a job. He sent for his family. I think I was a baby, and my mother carried me to Detroit on a train in a basket. We lived in the black bottom section of Detroit for 10 years. It was kind of the poorest of the poor section, since that young immigrant families from the South would be a, it would be the cheapest place for them to stay. We lived in a rather pseudo-Victorian old brick apartment building called the Quintanetta, 2111 Quintanetta. There was a lot full of weeds, broken bottles right next door, which we call the vacant lot. With the vacant lot in the alley with our playground. And, the alley was an interesting alley where we would play baseball and other games, because there were always dead rats all over the place that were smashed, which we never paid any attention to. It was like people these days growing up around flowers. We didn't have flowers, we had dead rats. That was part of the culture. And, you know, we were poor, but we didn't realize we were poor. We were, you know, we were happy. Our parents were very good parents, very caring parents. And, you know, if one has never drunk a glass of wine, you can't miss it. I didn't realize houses had grass in front of them until my uncle bought us a house on Normandy, and we would go out to visit them for Blackwater, and we noticed all the houses had grass in front of them, which was something I'd never seen before. You know, we lived about two blocks down the street from the major grade school, which was Duffield. And, I remember our mother was always read to us when we were kids. She would always read us to sleep. We always had to go to sleep at 7:30. And she would, and we would walk to the park. There was a little park there on Sherman Street where she would take us to play. It was right above Duffield School. And I remember when my brother enrolled at Duffield School, we would walk up to get him from the school. And it was like when the doors would open, it was like an explosion. All the kids would run out. It was like a mob of kids. And one day I think my brother stole a pencil sharpener. At least he brought it home. And my mother, my older brother Robert, was about 2 years and 9 months older than I was. And my mother took him to school to meet his teacher. Of course, all the teachers were white. And was very upset that he had taken this pencil. And the teacher, rather disdainful, said she couldn't care that all these kids were all going to wind up going to jail anyway, and she, what they really weren't interested in educating them. They just wanted to keep them disciplined. And so my mother was rather disenchanted with the education that was being offered her kids in the so-called promised land of Detroit. So we had a neighbor.
Did your mother only have sixth grade education?
My mother went to school to the ninth grade. My father went to school to the sixth grade. So
that's why you think they stress education.
Well, I think they realized that my mother realized that education might be a key to survival for us. But we had a neighbor who lived across the street on St. Aubin. called Mrs. The neighbor, Mrs. Seals. Mrs. Steele. She had a very intelligent daughter, and my mother asked her were there any choices for her kids, and Mrs. Steele suggested she try a Catholic school, which was on the outskirts of Black Bottom in Greektown near downtown Detroit. So she transferred my brother out of Duffield, enrolled him in a Catholic school. And when I was 5 years old, they stuck me in the Catholic school. St. Mary's was like a three-story old brick building. They had a commercial grade upstairs, which was for people like, for high school graduates, I guess, where they trained people and how to be secretaries. It's interesting because the commercial school is always all white, and the grade school was predominantly almost all black. There were a few Italian kids there, and there were a few Greek kids because we schools in Greektown. It was an interesting experience for me because I was 5 years old at the time, and our first teacher was Sister Eloise. Sister Eloise was a holy terror. She would take your knuckles and hit them with a ruler if you got out of line.
Maybe if they did that now, kids would go around shooting at other kids.
Maybe so, but Sister Mary Eloise, she was a brilliant teacher, but she kept us disciplined. The whole school from first to eighth grade only had about 100 kids. It was like one extended family. But I remember once I had to go urinate, and I was afraid to ask them to go urinate. So I kept trying to hold it and hold it and hold it. And finally, I couldn't hold it, so I had to go. And I guess I went on myself. Sister Eloise, I think, went off on me. And then she called my father up, and he came down and got me. And then I got another spanking when I got home. We lived in the Clintonetta, 2111 Clinton Street. Our Saturdays were always spent walking to Easton Market. It may have been maybe a half an hour walk at the most, 20 minutes to half an hour. And Easton Market was as packed now as it was then, if not more packed. And my parents used to buy their chickens live or their fish live. We would carry the live chickens home in bags. Freeman, our first cousin, who one of numerous cousins my parents were always rescuing from Mississippi, lived with us for 10 years. We would walk back holding two hands, holding these big bags full of eggs and chickens and vegetables, and they would be so heavy by the time we got home, we would have a line, an impression of a carrying cord, a carrying handle, the line in your hands. Your hands would be numb from holding those bags. I guess from growing up in the South, our chickens were always alive chickens. And we always used to go down the stairs to the alley because my father would wring their neck. And you could have one chicken in each hand. And you would just throw round and round and round and twirl it until the chicken's body would snap off from the neck. And the chicken would do a death dance. It would be amazing. The chicken with no head would dance for a few seconds around before he dropped dead. And then they used to boil the water and stick being plucked at that. And so we always had my mother's crispy fried chicken for Sunday. And my Uncle Bill and his family would always come over to have Sunday dinner with me. In some aspects, Black Bottom was like going back to the 19th century. In some aspects, 1950s and 1940s in Detroit was like being in the 19th century. We had a coal man, Mr. Smith, who lived across the street from us. We would buy our coal from him for the winter. He sold ice, he sold coal. He had his horse that would draw it. Our milkman still drove a horse, would drive to bring the milk. The milkman would come every day. We had Ruby, the numbers lady, used to come by and do the apartment building, and she would make her rounds. People would put a nickel. Black Bottom was, all the stores were operated, of course, by white folks. All the policemen were white folks. The insurance salesmen were white folks. We had one black police officer, Ben Turpin, on Street Station. I don't know if Ben was even allowed to arrest white folks. But he had two white pearl handle 45s. Whenever we would see him driving down the street in his little black car, the whole mob of kids would go running, saying, "There goes Ben Turpin. There goes Ben Turpin." And we would swarm. Yeah, we would swarm down the street after Ben Turpin. All the stores were, of course, operated by whites. There was Sam's, which was owned right on the corner where we lived, St. Auburn and Clinton. There was Louis on Mullet and Clinton. There was a drugstore across the street from Louis. But I remember a little store called Bailey's, which was about three or four blocks up. And it was kind of a, we called it a confectionery store. It sold little candies and things. You realize the 19th century is up. In fact, there was this brass bowl, which was about 3 feet wide and 3 feet high. Big metal brass. It had been oxidized green. And you used to always see it sitting on the corner there. And I didn't realize the significance until Sister Josella took a class to the Detroit Historical Museum, and they had one just like that. Apparently in the old days of Detroit, the horse and buggy area, they would have that out there with water in it for the horses to drink. I remember going to Bailey's, and some guy walking down the street after us told us to move on, and we just ignored him and kept on walking. So he pulled one in his pocket and pulled off his knife and started chasing us down the street. So we decided we would move on. So we all started running to get away from it.
Testing 1, 2, 3. It is March 27th, 1998, and we are conducting an oral history on Talbert Jones Small. This is the start of an epic. My name is Ayanna Small, and today we're going to talk about friends and neighbors and the significance of this community in Black Bottom.
We lived on the second floor of the Clintonetta. One would go up this wooden Victorian staircase to our apartment. We had four bedrooms. Correction, we had one bedroom in our apartment, a living room, a dining room. We had a heating stove in the dining room, which varied. It varied from oil to coal. And Freeman, who was like a big brother, stayed with us. My parents rescued him from Mississippi. And he stayed with us when he was around about 17, 18, until he was around 27, 28.
Just to get off
sidetracked
a little bit,
can
I ask you a question?
Freeman had Freeman had the bedroom.
He had the bedroom? Okay.
And, that's a good point, Yanni. Freeman was a very important name. My grandfather was called Freeman. I have two first cousins called Freeman because their parents wanted to let the world know that theirs, even though they may have been slaves, their children were not slaves. Mm-hmm. And Freeman's parents were slaves. And he wanted to let the world know, at least my grandfather Freeman, that they were not slaves. Anyway, obviously our closest friends growing up were the kids in the Clintonetta apartment building. We had a fat guy, if I remember, named Buddy, and another guy by the name of Horsey. There was actually a fellow by the name of Froggy before him. But we formed a little club in the behind the staircase of the Clintonetta was a little small open space, maybe about 5 feet by 5 feet. So we built a tent, and we had a little clubhouse there, and we had a little pirate side, and we had a sign that said, no girls allowed. This was pre-TV area, and so pre-TV, we were very creative. We would make skate boxes, swords. We would play creative games, just kick the can. Because since one didn't have a idiot box to be glued to, could be, write and draw and read and carve knives and swords and make stilts. We had a lot of creative energy with the kids, and then to not half a day because they're all glued to television sets. Mm-hmm. Of course, we all had our bully. Our local bully was a little few years older than I was, and a few years younger than my brother. His name was Fluky Baby, Robert Pounds. Robert Pounds used to terrorize the kids in the neighborhood. And I remember one little kid, he jumped on, and this kid actually whipped his butt. And his brother came by and saw this kid on top of him beating his Fluky Baby up, and he looked at Fluky Baby and said, "Now you're getting what you deserve."
Fluky Baby.
Everybody had a nickname. I was Baby Brother. This was his nickname, Fluky Baby. In the ghetto, everyone had a nickname. We even had a kid by the name of Skinny Pop.
Hey, I'm noticing a pattern significant. Do you think that's true for just the black culture in general? Significant names.
I think names have significance for all cultures. Mm-hmm. I think we're all human beings. We just come from different cultures. One pie, we're just different pieces of the pie. Anyway, Fluky Baby was always chasing my brother and myself. And one day, my brother, we all were taken, everyone in the neighborhood was boxing.
What year was this, or what time?
All the kids were going to Brewster to box because that's where Joe Lewis came from. Sugar Ray Robinson spent some time. Joe Lewis was from our neighborhood. And our parents, of course, would not let us leave the block. And then when they finally got, let us go across the street to play with a family called the Burnies, Peter Burney. There were three kids. But usually they would not let us leave the block. And so they would not let us go to Brewster to box with all our buddies. So they bought us boxing gloves so we could learn how to box. And I was a terrible boxer at the time because I always kept my hands down and I didn't protect my head, so I was always getting bopped in the head. But in fact, there was even a drawing in the brick wall in the basement, excellent drawing of a boxer. And as you would go towards the alley, But boxing was big. Everyone would watch Gillette's Monday night or Saturday night specials. And the boxers were a way of escaping from the ghetto. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Robert had learned a few boxing drills.
There weren't very many, historically at the time, there weren't very many black professional boxers.
Oh, the blacks were taking over the professional boxers. You know, after Joe Louis. But because prior to Joe Louis, they didn't want to have another Jack Johnson. So they wouldn't let, a lot of the great black fighters weren't giving a chance to fight. But Joe Louis was told he should never get his picture taken the white woman. He's always a white woman. It was okay for him to sleep with white women, but he couldn't get his picture taken with him. He was always to say, you know, sir, and yes, sir, and he was, you know, he was told that they wouldn't, you know, they didn't want another Jack Johnson. So Joe Louis knew the role he had to play. He was the only black man in America could knock white folks on the ass and not get lynched.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Joe Louis was fighting, the whole neighborhood was quiet. And we'd all be tuned into the radio. And after he'd knock someone out, then the lights would turn on and the whole neighborhood would be jumping. Anyway, back to my brother. My brother had learned a few boxing tricks, and so he got tired of being chased by Fluffy Baby. He started turning around and started boxing him. And he started bopping Plooky Baby in his head, and I think tears came and was coming down his eyes as he whipped Plooky Baby's buddy. Plooky Baby actually later became a very good friend of ours. He's I understand he's dead now. Even after we moved out of Black Bottom, he was one of the few people who actually would come out and take the bus out from Black Bottom to visit us on Linwood Avenue.
What?
You know, the neighborhoods were very close, and the neighbors were very close, and other people's parents, you know, we all know and respected them. They kind of looked out for us. And Lucky Baby's mother was Stell. She was a big, large, overweight black woman. And there was another even larger, overweight black woman who lived across the vacant lot from her, Willie. Willie had a bunch of sons. Several of them were retarded. And were completely inappropriate in their behavior. Willie's oldest son was Johnny. I think he stole a car and got busted in Georgia. Then she had a couple of teenager sons, Charlie D and Banda, who were really into boxing. And their cousin, John Lockhart, a.k.a. Pep, became actually our best friend in Black Bottom. But anyway, back to the adults. Flukey Baby was such a character. He said something in a very nasty manner to Willie one day. Willie turned to him and said something, "Your mother ain't here to beat your ass, so I'm going to beat your ass." And she took a belt or some type of weapon and whipped that poor boy all the way up three flights of stairs. He lived on the third flight of the apartment building above us. Now I can see Big Willie now wielding that belt. This poor kid has beat him up every step. No one messed with Willie.
Okay.
At the time that our last few years of Black Bottom, guy by the name of Pep, who was the oldest child, I think his parents had about five or six children, became Roberts and I our best friend. Pep was between my brother's age and my age. He was a very good boxer. We used to box together. In fact, we used to look for jobs together. I remember walking up to the hardware store, which still exists on Gratiot, on the outskirts of Eastern Market, and asking the people for a job. And they, of course, told us to come back when we were 17 and they'd hire us. We used to sell the newspapers together on the Michigan Chronicle and the Pittsburgh Courier. In fact, we traveled all over Black Bottom, all up and down Lafayette, downtown. selling these newspapers. And we were in front of Sam's Cutrate. I think I was in front of Sam's Cutrate. And Robert was in the back of it. And we were, and the guy asked him to come to the parking lot. About a 16, 17-year-old kid who, when Robert got to the parking lot, he pulled a knife on him and robbed him. And so after my brother got robbed, that was the end of our newspaper career at Black Bottom. We used to pick up our newspapers from Mr. Peoples, one of the few black-owned confectionery stores across the street from Duffield School. And Peoples was a graying, black-complexioned gentleman who operated one of the few black-owned businesses in Black Bottom. It's interesting, the person who robbed Robert turned out to be the nephew of the guy who ran the bicycle shop at Black Bottom. And we used to see him riding down the street to his uncle's bicycle shop. So once all of our kids started chasing him down the street, in the middle of the street, telling him he robbed someone. So he, true to form, stopped his bicycle and pulled his knife off of us. So we all did a hasty retreat from him in his ninth period. So anyway, going up the background, I think there was a lot of poverty, but we didn't know we were poor. It was the only world we knew. I believe his name was Mr. Rivers. We used to, our bicycles were really quite fanciful work of art there, unlike the bicycles there, because we have fenders. Yeah, we had fenders, flaps, we had horns, we had light bulbs, we had colored lights that we could put inside the axle that we could turn on and go round and round. There were just, you know, many way gadgets. I think my parents paid $55 for my bicycle, and which was probably a lot of money in those days. The king of the bicycles was the Swin, and that was the chrome bicycle, it sold for about $100. We were, of course, quite creative in making our own toys until the TV made its doors at the Black Bottom. Mr. Stevenson, Mr. and Mrs. Stevenson, she later died. He worked at Briggs Stadium. Almost everybody in Black Bottom worked at some factory. He bought the first television set. And at that time, TVs were a work of art, and that they all had either walnut or mahogany or oak cabinets, and they were like a piece of furniture. Get a combination television set, tape recorder, radio. And he had an analog television set. It was a walnut cabinet. And of course, we would go over there and watch TV after school. And my brother had to get his appendix out. And my parents promised him a television set if he got his appendix out. And so, when you guys finished out, they bought a TV set, a DuPont television set. It was around $600, which was quite a lot of money then, because when you take into consideration the most my father ever made was $5,000 a year. That was almost like 10% of the set of his annual salary. Black and white DuPont television. That's a beautiful hardy cabinet. It's a beautiful piece. In fact, it's still sitting in my parents' basement in Detroit now. But I think my parents saw the writing on the wall for Black Bottom. For years, they would talk about urban development and tearing down Black Bottom, although it took them years to tear down, and that's what most urban developers, the land lied empty for years before they finally rebuilt it. about that. But when I was 10 years old, my parents gave us the option of either buying a car or a house. We couldn't afford to do both, so we said, get us a house and get us out of Black Box, which is how we started looking for a house. And they eventually bought a house on Midland Avenue for about $13,500. They had already started tearing down parts of Black Bottom while we were living up there. They hadn't gone past the railroad tracks, and we used to go in the abandoned buildings and pick up parts from the things. But it was really very slow because we left Black Bottom, I think, in 1953. And I remember when I was a sophomore in college, which was, must have been around about 1961, Lucius Tripp and I went through our the area where we used to live, in the Clinton Avenue, and of course the building was still there. We went into our own apartment and looked at it. It was still there. The bathroom with the old toilet seat was still sitting there, and they hadn't torn the building down yet. And so, like most urban development problems, they purely urban renewal. And I always felt that once the remodel ever opened up a middle class neighborhood, but now the previous occupants of the area could afford to live, which essentially what happened. The area now, they're down to town Detroit, the Lafayette Plaza is a very developed neighborhood where none of the former residents of the Black Bottom could afford to live. We talked earlier about St. Mary's, and I thought maybe we should go from Black Bottom to St. Mary's. Obviously, we'll need to organize that better, but this at least gives us some working framework. And I already told earlier how I got involved going to St. Mary's when I was 5 years old. St. Mary's was a school on the outskirts of Black Bottom in Greektown. We used to walk there during the bus strikes. It might be maybe a half an hour walk at the most. And my brother, I would tag along with my brother, we'd take the St. Auburn bus. St. Auburn, Glenwood, I think originally you rode it from Nicolino, went up to Dye. Rain, winter, snow. We bussed our way to St. Mary's. St. Mary's was actually found by the Germans. It was a church for the German ethnic group in the early part of the 19th century. It's a beautiful, towering church. If it were in, they couldn't have it in California because the earthquake was destroyed. But I don't know if you've ever been inside of it, but it's there.
Yeah, I'm
it's a beautiful stained glass. And the original church was more colorful than was now because there was a lot of gold trim and gold paintings and gold and pictures all over the wall. It's since been repainted.
I remember you took me to it.
And the school itself only had about 100 kids in the grade school. And then it had a commercial school, which was all white women. It's just the Constance and Sister Ambrose talk. The priests were the Holy Ghost Fathers. Father Tiefel was the pastor for most of the years I was there.
What's Holy Ghost?
That's the name of their order. Holy Ghost was the third person of the Blessed Trinity. It's God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Three persons, one God. Anyway, the school sisters were from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The Notre Dame sisters, they had another school there called St. Anthony's, and then they had a school that was in D.C. opened up called St. Benedict. And there were really only three classrooms. Sister Eloise taught the first and second grade. There was Sister Grace and later Sister Ramona who taught us in the third, fourth grade. Sister Josella taught the fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. So eventually, it's amazing that you'd have two and sometimes four classes. And she would go from one class to the other and go over our work to do and then go to the next class and the next class and the next class. Did you teach those many classes? I suspect my senior class probably only had about 8 students in it. But it was a very extended family, you know, because the people we're friends even to this day, you know, the people who went to school there. And the nuns, they were interested in converting us to be Catholics, of course, but they were interested in teaching us, which the school teachers in the public schools were not. They were interested in teaching us to read, write, and do everything. And so we were able to compete when we went to high school and college. We could compete and do as well as we wanted to do, because they were very interested in teaching us academics. There were no athletic teams there. The fire department had closed the basketball thing upstairs. It was on the fourth floor. It's kind of, the boys played in a little small playground. We usually played games like mob, where everyone go grab someone and throw them down and jump on top of them. Or we used to play a game where you take a ball and hit someone with it. And you grab the ball and hit them, and you take turns running around, chasing after someone hitting with the ball. And you probably remember Russell Ponsetti, who we used to call Sheephead, and his brother Goathead, because we used to call them that because the heads were so hard. We would hit them, I remember, the ball would bounce up, and then they would turn around and laugh at us, so you didn't hurt us. That's how they got their nickname. And the girls played in the alley, because the girls were separated from the boys in the playground. So we used to have a little sign to put up in the alley. It's a little alley in back of Greektown now. And our former playground was a parking lot. We would put a little signs up to stop the traffic, and they would play in the alley. So since the Eloise taught us to add and subtract and beat our knuckles with the ruler, Sister Ramona was a lot sweeter. She would beat our knuckles with the ruler. She taught us to multiply, and then of course we had all been baptized and we were all confirmed in the third grade. And so, and then we taught Sister Eloise. Sister Josella taught us. She was a very smart nun. But it was very interesting. I recall that, you know, give me an example of racism. She said that I guess most of their churches were in white neighborhoods because they were told when they were going to Detroit that they were going to be teaching a black parish. And she said they grew up with all types of stereotypes of black folks and dirty and nasty. And she remarked how clean the kids were. And of course, you know, every Easter, like the rebirth of Christ, is tradition in the black community for all the kids to get suits. So our parents used to buy us a suit every Easter, and of course we would wear our suits to church every Sunday. So we were gross, neatly dressed, clean kids that the sisters had ever came in contact with. And I remember once they invited us all over to the nunnery to meet a black nun and officiate those that would become a nun. Sister was so proud. She said it used to be we didn't allow black folks to become nuns in her order, but that's changed, and now we're getting our first black nun. So it's really interesting how powerful the apartheid and racism is in our society, even in these good nuns who are doing good, teaching and support black folks in education. When my brother graduated from grade school, he was going to go, they told him that nuns pretty much pushed us to go to a Catholic high school. If someone was going to a public high school, they would tell them that they were getting ready to sell their soul to the devil anyway. They told us that the best high schools were either University of Detroit or Catholic Central, and my brother chose to go to the University of Detroit. He's actually the first black person to admit he was black to go to school there. And the nuns told him that that the people there weren't used to having black folks, so they would have to really, kind of like the Joe Louis model, who always did best behavior, because they would be judging all black folks from him, mm-hmm. which of course probably put a lot of pressure on my brother. My brother was a very good athlete, as was I, and he was a B student his first year there, but it was, yeah, he was on the football team and the band, but I think he couldn't deal with being the only black person there, because he had moved in 1953 to Linwood Avenue, and Livernois Avenue pretty much was white on the other side, so when he would go home, his buddies would go down to Livernois Avenue, and then they would be street fighting with the white kids. Didn't even go to school, white folks of the day, and so he stopped studying and told me this speech class. He brought a gun there and gave a talk on how to make a zip gun or something in a speech class. And my father listened to me. And so he got terrible grades his sophomore year. And I think Father Sullivan, who was the principal, told him that if he wanted to stay on there, they would pass him. He could become a junior. But if he left, they were going to flunk him. I think the Jesuits wanted him to stay because they didn't have very many black students there. He was the first one. But he decided to leave and go to Central High School. So he left the year I started. And we had a little more support group because there were three of our classmates from St. Mary's who were there, Charles Cotman, Evan Allen, and myself. So at least culturally, we came from a black culture, which was separate and unequal from the white culture in Detroit. There were people we could at least talk among ourselves and compare notes. You asked me whether I ran into much racism in high school. You know, there were subtle cultural reforms. I really ran into more racism in college or in medical school than I did in high school. There was one kid, Benjamin Rich, who came, I think he was from Dearborn, who came up to me one day and asked me what we were doing going to school there, how we should be going to black schools and should be going to their schools. But there were subtle type things. Like, I was a rather introverted kid and didn't socialize that much. And I recall when we graduated from high school, none of us, there were lots of dances with the high school seniors were involved in, but none of the black kids, at least Charles, myself, there was a fourth black person there, but no one knew it was black. Arthur Body, his father, uncle was a famous novelist, Frank Yerby, but he looked white. His father was a doctor, so they didn't know he was black. he went to Yale, I think. But none of us were invited to go to any of the dances or anything. I probably wouldn't have went anyway, but it was just no one gave us an invitation to go. I had gotten to be a pretty good track athlete. I could probably beat everyone on the team from the 100-yard dash to the half mile. And I recall about a week before our first meet, Claire Kearney, who ran 100-200, asked me to race him after practice. So probably around the 30-yard line, I was pulling away from him about 3 or 4 feet. And I tore my hamstring muscle. So I told the coach the next day I was whipping it from his butt. Of course, he said he didn't believe it. But Claire actually won the 100 and 200-yard dash in the Catholic leagues. But I was actually faster than he was, not anyone else. But I rested for 2 weeks, and the coach said, well, we're going to make you run against Catholic Central. So I tried to run, and all I did was tear the hamstring muscle again. I had planned to go to college on track scholarship. And I figured I could probably win the 100-yard dash in the parochial leagues and maybe the 400-yard dash in the states. But that was the end of my track career. Even when I went to college, the college coach used to always try to tell me to come out for the track team, you could become a champion. But I decided I'd rather do well academically. I got an academic scholarship. I was in high school from 1959 to 1963. I went to college. I went to the University of Detroit College. And I guess Hugh Smith, the vice president, told me, Father Salvo told him to look after me. I had about 3.8 average my first year, and so I got a General Motors scholarship. But to give you an example of the racism, when I had my interview during my sophomore year, Gerstenberg, who was the vice president of General Motors, then became president of General Motors, he asked me what I wanted to do. I told him I was thinking about going into psychiatry and medical school. If this racism, he told me that was supposed to be very difficult, and I shouldn't do that. I should choose another career. So I refused to go to dinner. So he told Father Smith to take away my scholarship because I didn't show up at the dinner. And Father Smith, of course, I was begging him to do that. I later found this from a friend, Albert Brooks, told me Father Smith told me the story. Oh, it was interesting, because usually I would wind up scoring the highest mark in the room, or sometimes the highest mark ever. But it's almost like you had to do that to get an A, because the teachers were so stereotyped against black folks. One of my German teachers came out and said, you've got the highest marks in the room, and they tell us that black folks can't learn. He's actually originally from Czechoslovakia, and at the end of World War II, I think the Nazis grabbed him as a teenager and stuck him in the army. What was his name? He told the whole class that. I took qualitative analysis, and I had the highest mark in the room. Probably the highest mark ever. And I took quantitative analysis, and the teacher there, I used to do my research in the afternoon, because I didn't like the lab. So he came up and told me that I don't believe you did any of this lab work. So I think he was probably just going to fail me. Then he checked my grades and found out I was making A's and everything. He says, well, I'll give you an incomplete, but the highest mark you can get is a C, because he said the rules said that once you get an incomplete, you can't get any higher than a C. So I had to do all the lab work over again. Then I took organic at summer and scored the highest mark ever in the room. But this was what we had to deal with. I took a philosophy class once. I had A's on my exam. I had A on the finals. The teacher was from Dearborn.